Hello and welcome to How Curious. I'm Rachel Hopkin.
Gentlemen and friends of aviation, travel by train and airplane from California to the East or from the East to California is the modern achievement in transportation. To save time, see America first, and to enjoy the real fun of flying, I recommend it to you.
It's 1929 and a group of prescient investors have banded together. They have a vision of getting people across America far quicker than is possible by train alone by creating a service that combines rail travel at night with flying during the day.
And they laid out a route going from New York to Los Angeles that included airports and train stations.
That's How Curious listener Dale Wares who suggested this story. Back in the 1920s, the idea of airplanes carrying passengers was pretty novel. Tom Weichel and Dale Lightfoot are both scholars and aviators.
After World War I, very few people had ridden an airplane. The very early commercial service really began with airmail. Passengers would ride in airmail planes. It wasn't really very comfortable because you'd be riding with airmail bags.
It wasn't like there was an airport or a site where you could go buy tickets or something like that. It would be an ad hoc arrangement.
So when did this idea of transcontinental air travel come about?
You know, Charles Lindbergh is such a big figure. He was a rock star after his 1927 flight across the Atlantic. He was the driving force in what happened in Oklahoma with transcontinental air transport. And he was the main planner for that route. But it was this idea that, you know, hey, we would like to have a system that would get you across the country in much less time than trains.
Keep in mind, in 1929, night travel was considered to be really risky. And they wanted this to be safe. And that's why they combined the rails overnight and the flying during the day.
In the heart of New York, a great railroad station is the beginning of your transcontinental rail and air journey from coast to coast.
The Transcontinental Air Transport Company, or TAT's, route plan would take just 48 hours, a considerable improvement on the 3, 4 or more days that the train alone would typically take.
There's a new kind of spirit in the air each day when this train departs. It's like those moments before a smart deluxe liner sets sail for Paris and the Riviera.
And as you might guess from that deluxe liner analogy, this service was marketed to the very rich, with a one-way ticket costing around $6,500 in today's money. The route, as planned by Lindbergh, took advantage of pre-existing rail facilities. Three locations were selected to be the points where passengers switch from air to rail or vice versa. Columbus, Ohio to the east, Clovis, New Mexico to the west. Then they needed somewhere right in the middle of the country. And that's where the small town of Winoka, Oklahoma came into play.
Oh my goodness!
This is downtown Winoka back in the thriving days.
When I visited Winoka a short while back, I was met by residents Neil and Mary Lou Goucher, along with Charlene Bixler from the local historical society, and shown a delightful award-winning model train replica of the town.
This was our setup and depot or ticket office for the passenger trains. You can see a little person in the window there that would sell you a ticket.
Oh yeah!
Winoka's in the northwest of the state, up towards the Panhandle.
It began in 1887 when the railroad put the first railroad car in a siding and called it actually Keystone. A year or two later, it was determined that there was another Keystone in Oklahoma already, so they had to change the name.
It's rumored that Winoka means sweet water. What is sure is that water played a big part in the development of the town.
In 1907, the railroad changed its division point from Woodward, Oklahoma to Winoka because of our abundance of water. The railroad's steam engines, of course, had to have water to function. When the change was made, Winoka started growing by leaps and bounds. And in 1910, this building was a result.
It was built to house a Harvey House restaurant. Harvey Houses were a big deal back in the day, a series of high-end eateries established by Fred Harvey in concert with the Santa Fe Railroad and located at stops on the line across the U.S.
Beautiful arrangement because he had the capability of serving fresh food every day that the railroad would bring in. If he wanted to serve seafood, they could ship it to him. If he wanted fresh flowers on the table, he could get it off the trains.
That Winoka had this upscale venue already in place was a factor for the TAT. But first and foremost, what it needed was a place where planes could safely land and take off. Here's Tom Weichel again.
It was actually Lindbergh who landed in a field near the place where the airfield was built. It was a wheat field at the time, and just said, this is perfect. And it was only about 5 miles away from the city of Winoka, where the Harvey House was.
So this is the edge of the hangar.
The land where the airport was built is now owned by farmer Chet Olson. He showed me the concrete slab on which the TAT hangar once stood, at the time the third largest in the US, and pointed out two small buildings. One used to house a fire engine, the other was a communications hub.
As a young kid, I would drive a tractor, and sometimes I would pull up cable that they would run out to the lights. I never saw the actual runway, but it was lighted.
In fact, the TAT was really operating at the cutting edge, according to Tom Weichel and Dale Lightfoot.
It was really very advanced because they had things like obstruction lighting that had never been used before. What that is, it's like if you have a taller building like a hangar, you put a red light on the top.
They also had two-way radio communication, and not only meteorological facilities and an on-field meteorologist at Winoka and the other airports that TAT used, but they had them at regular intervals all across the United States, so that they could get regular weather updates along the way, because that just improved the safety.
One other thing I might mention, they were very proud of their pilots. They had a minimum requirement of 3,000 hours, and that's a lot of flight hours today. A airline transport pilot has to have 1,500 hours to fly a commercial airliner, but 3,000 is, that's a lot of experience. One of the things that they did when you got on board the airplane, they had a brochure. It was sort of a description and biography about the pilots.
In addition, the TAT gave out maps which highlighted landmarks which could be spotted along the way. After all, their planes were traveling at a far lower altitude than passenger jets do today.
They were flying at 2,500 feet off the ground. So you were low and slow. You could see everything below you. You had these panoramic views of the whole landscape. So that's why they provided these maps.
In a 1929 promo film for the company, viewers were assured that
the airliners nowadays are as snug and comfortable as your own private yacht.
Yes, exactly. Just like your yacht. So there were all kinds of niceties to make the experience as luxurious as possible. Each passenger was seated in a roomy individual wicker chair next to a window.
They had meals that were served in insulated boxes that were kind of the early precursors of what food services and airlines today.
Back then, these were new and exciting.
They even had in-flight movies. They would pull a screen down behind the cockpit and have a projector in the back. So very innovative, even at this very early stage.
There were some passengers who, because of weather, had to ride the train on a segment that they ordinarily would have been in an airplane. It was a big disappointment.
Today, airplanes are often touted as the safest form of travel, but this was not the case back in the 1920s. As a result, alongside ensuring a lavish passenger experience, the TAT execs did everything they could to make safety a priority, including buying a fleet of the highly reputable Ford Trimotor aircraft, and they sought to reassure the jitters of potential fare payers in their promo.
These motors, incidentally, are looked after as carefully as a fine wash. And after being in use for a specified number of hours, each motor is completely overhauled by a corps of experts working under the supervision of Colonel Lindbergh. As technical advisor to the airline, Colonel Lindbergh has instilled his own insistence upon perfect motor performance, overhauling and frequent replacements, which from his experience is the way to safety in flying.
Such efforts evidently satisfied the editor of a local newspaper, who trumpeted in its pages the words,
"Flying safer than standing behind a mule."
I'm not sure that would have convinced me to get on board. In any case, amid much fanfare, the airport was dedicated in June of 1929, and the inaugural trip took place the following month. So began a period of great excitement in the town of Winoka. Here's Charlene Bixler again.
It was such a glorious time, that 18 months, because the community started to build and grow, and there was even a high-rise hotel built downtown. It was so fascinating because of the people that were in and out, the celebrities that were here. Charles Lindbergh and Amelia Earhart herself spent several nights in our Harvey House right here where we're sitting.
Like Lindbergh, Earhart was an aviation superstar, and she'd been employed by the TAT in part to promote the airline to female customers.
She was invited to be the guest of the local ladies' club. One of those meeting times, she was invited to my husband's great-grandmother's home for their meeting that evening, and she spent about 2 hours at her house. So it's pretty exciting for our family.
Charlene's kept a tally of some of the other celebrities who grace the town. They include
Mary Pickford, Irene Dunne, John Gilbert. Then we had Lionel Barrymore, Will Rogers, Greta Garbo. Lady Vanderbilt was here. Lon Chaney, that used to play the old scary movies. Gloria Swanson, Mae West, Wallace Beery, and Jackie Cooper. It was a pretty good list of the rich and famous, actually.
But perhaps the most celebrated of them all was still Charles Lindbergh. So the fact that he made repeated trips to Winoka was really a boon for the townspeople.
When Lindbergh had a meal downstairs, people would watch and wait for him to leave. They would grab his plate, his fork, his napkin, whatever they could get his hands on, sometimes breaking the plate in two so they could share a piece that Charles Lindbergh had eaten out of. Another time, he and his wife were both here having dinner in the dining room, the formal dining room. The cornbread that evening happened to be just exceptional, and he asked to meet the baker. And I keep thinking to myself that if I were that baker, I'd be bouncing out of the kitchen to go meet him.
In turn, the town made quite an impression on Lindbergh's wife, Anne, as noted in a letter she wrote at the next main stop on the line in Clovis, New Mexico.
Winoka, I have never been in a place like it. It is smaller than this, has 4 or 5 paved streets and a hotel, 1 big room downstairs for meeting, eating, registering, buying, and smoking cigars, spitting, and talking. At least I presume all this. I only looked at it through the open door. We got a room at the Harvey House and slept well in spite of 2 or 3 trains going under our window. It all felt very, very Western. The quiet, the lack of pressure or touch with progress. Not that Western towns aren't progressive, but a small, distant country town isn't.
That statement is rather at odds with what she goes on to write about the new facilities.
TAT has built a magnificent field and hangar, the equipment being the most modern, efficient, progressive, down to the last detail. All the town came out to see the dedication. Some townsmen said there hadn't been such a crowd since the dedication of the pavement.
Yet despite all the fanfare and precautions, the TAT venture didn't do well. Partly they were just unlucky in launching only months ahead of the Wall Street crash, with the markets already in turmoil. Then, and this broke my heart a little, there was an actual crash. One of those bright new tri-motors came down in New Mexico with a loss of all crew and passengers.
It set the airline back in a significant way, and the number of empty seats was pretty high on these planes. So they were trying to get more people interested in flying. They had discounts. They even used company employees. They would fly TAT employees just to make it look like the airline had a few more people.
But what really sealed the fate of the TAT's presence in Winoka was actually advancing technology, as local history buff Neil Goucher explained.
Time moved on, and we find out that we didn't need to have all of these airplanes landing and taking off because they had bigger and better airplanes, planes that could fly clip across the country.
In October 1930, the TAT quietly closed its Winoka operation. Later, the company merged into the enterprise that would become TWA.
They sold that hangar for $10,000 to a company in Little Rock, Arkansas, and the hangar was rebuilt and still is there and still in use. Somehow we survived before and during and after, and we're still here, relying on tourism now. So essentially that's what that was too.
One of the visitor attractions is the Winoka Air Rail Museum, which is housed in its historic Harvey House, and which documents the TAT's association with the town, which, though short, remains significant.
It was the start of all of these technologies that later expanded and became more available to other people. It was just a relatively brief period of time where they kind of combined the old and the new, you know, like the rail travel overnight and the planes during the day.
I mean, it really was such a moment, and it was just this very brief time, but it was and just things
transformed. And Winoka was involved in the middle of it all. I mean, that's what's remarkable. Little Winoka, Oklahoma was at the center, literally, figuratively and literally at the center of all that. And so Winoka's place in aviation history is sealed.
Dale Lightfoot there. Thanks to him and all of the contributors to this episode, including readers Robbie Korth and Stephanie Royce. And a huge shout out to listener Dale Wares for bringing this story to How Curious. You can see photos of Winoka both then and now on the episode webpage. Search for KGOU and How Curious. How Curious is a KGOU public radio production. The managing editor is Logan Layden. David Gray composed our theme music, and I'm Rachel Hopkin. And if you too have an idea for us, please drop us a line at curious@kgou.org.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.